it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon, and it's the return of snooker player bingo. Many people have demanded it. You know, I'm not a performing monkey, but I've weakened, and we're going to unleash that shortly. But Phil Yates is here with me. We'll explain what it's all about for new listeners. But first, Phil, well, I should explain, you might hear some background music, because the table fitters are working hard on setting up the, or doing the tables for the qualifying at the weekend, European Masters. We're here at the Championship League. It's our fourth week. We've been here a while. What are your sort of reflections?
Well, I've really enjoyed it. I think it's great to see so many players. Every day there's a new cast list, which is great if you're commentating, because obviously it's not repetitive in any way. I've been impressed by the majority of the top players. We've had 30 completed groups so far, and 18 top seeds have come through. There have been shocks, though. Mark Selby and Barry Hawkins played well and went out. Judd Trump didn't play well by his standards. He was very rusty. And also, Kyron Wilson, I thought, played very poorly to go out as well. But generally speaking, the form book is held up. I think the highlights for me, I thought Ben Wollaston played superbly to win his group, and particularly to overcome Mark Selby. So maybe he's one to watch in the next phase. And it was really nice to see a couple of amateurs, Q School top-ups, do well. Daniel Wells is one of his groups, so he's still involved. And Florian Nursler from Austria coming second in his group. That was good to see.
Well, here's the thing, and because unusually online there's been some criticism of the event, but the first 3 weeks, I was talking to Jake from Matchroom, who looks after all the social media and everything. First 3 weeks, in terms of TV, YouTube, Facebook, all the places where you can see either live coverage streaming or clips or any content associated with the Championship League, they had 5.2 million views. So clearly a lot of people are watching.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's a perfect way to get the season started. And it gives the lower-ranked players the opportunity to play, if they're in the Table 1 group, the opportunity to play in front of TV cameras three times in a day, and I think that really is good for them, especially the rookies. Mm. It gives them a grounding. I always think back to Pang Junsu, who played in the Championship League a couple of years ago, and he looked very unimpressive to me, and I was saying to people, yeah, I don't think he's going to be good enough. And then he had a wonderful rookie year, won the Rookie of the Year, and you know, now he's doing really, really well, and he's clearly got a great temperament and a really good future. And I think playing in that Championship League really helped him to become accustomed to conditions and also to being in front of the TV cameras, and now he's right at home. And I think that will have the same effect for so many players.
Yes, and also we've seen some young European players, in particular Ben Mertens and Florian Nursler, who both finished second in their respective groups. Very talented, but also great attitude. They didn't get down on themselves, they didn't... You know, they weren't sort of moaning all day long. They obviously, they're young, it's new to them, and it's experience for them. Ben's on the tour, and Florian obviously is trying to get on the tour. But anyway, that's the Championship League. It continues next week, final week. Now, snooker player bingo, we've done it in the past. But essentially, it's this. I've written down the names of 10 snooker players, pretty much of the past. And Phil is going to pick a number, and that number will correspond to a player. And we're just going to talk about that player for a few minutes and then move on to the next one. It's quite niche, but, you know, it's a snooker podcast, so what do you expect? So, Phil, we've got number 1 to 10. You don't know the names in advance, but pick a number.
I'm in heaven, number 7.
Well, number 7 is a former world champion in... Well, he was world champion after the Joe Davis era and before the TV era, John Pulman. who, of course, probably best known actually now as a commentator. He commentated on the first Maximum Break on TV.
Yeah, well...
But I should say, sorry, Phil, I should say, we may have done some of these before. I couldn't bother to check, but anyway.
Well, John Pulman won the World Championship on several occasions. Clearly, it was very different then. Not the tournament structure we have now. But the fact is, he did win it, and he was a very good player. I think there are a couple of stories about Pulman. One is one that's actually negative against him, but just shows how the game has come on in standard. When he won the English Amateur Championship before he turned pro, in the final, it was quite a lengthy match, and his highest break was 25. Now, that would be impossible to reconcile these days. The other thing about Pulman was that he had an absolutely ferocious temper. When he had bad luck against him, he used to visibly get annoyed. Clive Everton has told me some extraordinary stories about him, you know, losing control. And he just didn't like it at all. Now, when he was playing Fred Davis, and Fred had a fluke, of course, Fred was completely the opposite. He was quite sort of calm and laughed and smiled. And I think that used to rile Pulman up even more. The other thing I will say about John is that he got an absolutely wonderful voice.
Oh, yeah.
For commentary. Yeah. Brilliant voice for commentary. And I think, of the old commentators, I think he would have fitted in modern times, because he was very witty as well. There was a tournament many years ago which was sponsored by Yamaha Organs, and the the prize for the high break was a Yamaha organ. Yeah. And at one point, his co-commentator said, well, if he pots brown, blue, pink and black, he's going to equal the high break. And Pulman said, well, you know, what happens then? What do you do with half an organ? But he had plenty of other...
Well, here's the thing. I don't think he got enough credit. I think he came out with one of the great lines of commentary on that 147 at the very end. Steve's on the black. And, of course, David Taylor got very excited. And he's kind of talking over it. And Pulman remained in that sort of very sort of sober manner. And he said... Of Davis, he said he can see the pockets closing up and getting smaller, which is a perfect illustration of what it must feel like under pressure when, you know, when you have to pot something. It is suddenly the pocket smaller.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing with Pulman was, although he was the world champion in the 50s, he did play at the Crucible as well. So he did cross the generations. Yeah, I didn't have a great amount of dealings with him, but the ones I did, I found him quite engaging and quite a good person to be in company with. He obviously enjoyed a sort of, how shall we put it, he enjoyed a drink, didn't he? So that was that was definitely part of his makeup, and he was a very social person. And at tournaments in the early 90s when I started, late 80s, he really enjoyed himself.
There was a great story about he had a massive tax bill or something, and they rang him up, the Inland Revenue, and he was sort of a couple of glasses in for the evening. They rang him up and they sort of said, you know, Mr. Pulman, you know, you owe all this money. And he just said, I know nothing about this. Put the phone down. That was the end of it. No, great character. And like you say, you know, he had that sort of, he brought humour to commentary, which wasn't necessarily always the way back then. Lovely voice, yeah.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, he really was a genuine character. And I think, as I say, if he was around now, he would fit into the commentary scene. Obviously, it's very different now to what it was then. But definitely with his experience and his gravitas and his voice and his ability with words, he must have been pretty well read, because he was, you know, he came across as being educated. Let's put it that way.
OK, well, you've had number seven, Phil. So what's your next number?
OK, key to the door number four.
Well, it wasn't world champ, but he could have been, I think. Potentially, at one point, he was maybe touted as one. Steve James, West Midlander.
Well, I knew Steve very well. The last time I saw Steve, actually, I was sitting next to him at the funeral of our good friend, John Dee. Steve James was on the team at Wensbury Conservative Club that John put together, which was a superstar league team in the West Midland League. It was Steve James, Anthony Harris, Martin Clark, Jim Chambers, who all became professionals, and a lad called Steve Baldwin, who actually was a very hard player to beat. So I actually played Steve as well on a few occasions in pro-ams at Walsall or at the tournament in Snow Hill in Birmingham. And it was obvious when I was playing him back then he was going to be something special. Steve James, he's a great asset. And I think he's one of the best players I've ever seen. Potting balls down the side cushions. Mm. Now, I know that's, to use a word you've already employed, niche. But he was excellent at that. And he was so aggressive. He was actually before his time. And he won the Mercantile Credit Classic as well. At a time when it was tough to win world-ranking events. So, credit to him.
And also, at a time when those events were the majors. Mm. We talk about majors now. Those ranking events were considered, all of them, major tournaments.
Yeah. Well, he beat Warren King in the final, but I think he beat Steve Davis on the way. The other thing with Steve was, because he was a lover of speed and, you know...
You should qualify that. You mean in terms of motorbikes?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, he loved the high-powered motorcycles, and he used to go at ridiculous speeds. And so he used to create stories like that if he had a crash or some kind of problem. And I remember on one occasion he created a great story for the tabloids. We were at Trentham Gardens in Stoke, and he went out on the boats on the lake there, and one of them sank while he was in it. So that was a good tale.
Well, of course, he's got two notable achievements at the cruise, but one, he's made the only 16 red break there against Alex Higgins. Of course, he beat him in that infamous match in 1990 when Alex wouldn't come out of the arena afterwards. And the other, of course, he beat Hendry. Crucible curse, he inflicted the curse on Hendry in 91. And around that time, I mean, obviously, you had Hendry, Davis, Parrott, White, they were the big four. But he was kind of seen maybe as a potential winner of the World Championship.
Definitely, absolutely. I think, funnily enough, it was at the Crucible, the match that precipitated his decline. He lost, very surprisingly, 10-9 to Dino Kane in the first round, having been 9-5 up. And I don't think he was ever quite the same after that. But certainly the match against Hendry. You know, he was one of those players. Hendry was not frightened of anyone, but he was one of those players. He was a real wild card, and if he played his best, all of the other players knew they could have their hands full. And he beat Hendry in the quarterfinals. There was a lot of talk about Hendry being burnt out because he'd had an incredible season, the 1990-91 season. He played in pretty much everything, and he got to most finals or went on to win the event. And I think there was a sort of an element of that, but also every credit to Steve James for getting the victory there. Yeah, I mean, who beat Hendry in the early 90s at the Crucible? I think it was him and him alone.
Well, it was until Ken in the final in 97. He was the only one in the 90s. Yeah. Okay, well, we've had 4 and 7, so another number.
Number 2.
Okay, you've given up on the actual bingo.
I just didn't know the one. What's the number 2?
No, well, this is niche now. Barry West.
Wow.
Well, I'll tell you something about Barry West. He was Stephen Hendry's first ever opponent in a world ranking event. There you go.
Right. Well, Barry West from South Yorkshire, a very shrewd player and a very shrewd person as well. The one thing I always remember about Barry was he really loved the game. Mm. You'd see him in arenas watching other people's games. Now, in pool, nine-ball pool, you see that a lot. One of the reasons is they want to work out how best to break off. So, quite often, if you see a pool tournament on TV, the camera will pan around and you'll see Shane Van Boning and the other superstars of the game actually watching other people play. Barry was like that, and it was because he was so into the game. Wasn't the heaviest scorer by any means, but he made the final stages of several big events on the BBC, had a good career, and yeah, he was a real snooker enthusiast.
Quite an enigmatic character. There was a story that, I don't know how true it was, but I remember I used to get that Benson Edge's yearbook. It was always in there every year when they did his profile, that he sat his O-levels, but he never went back to find out how he'd done. For some reason. So, to this day, we don't know what his grades were. Maybe he didn't think they'd be any good. I don't know.
Well, to spare this journalist's blushes, my next story, I won't mention who it was, but basically there was a youngster on the tour who was doing radio reports. And
now he's quite well known, actually, but anyway.
He is very well known now, yeah. Anyway, so we were at a tournament in Swindon, I believe, and Willie Thorne became one of a handful of players who made a century of centuries. Mm. And Willie was quite rightly very proud of it. And we trumpeted this in our radio reports that we did and in our newspaper reports. But the lad who was new to the snooker, who's now well known, was overhearing what I was saying, and he asked the press officer, who was a prankster, who are the other players who have made a century of centuries. Now, Steve Davis was definitely one of them. I think it was three or four at the time. But, of course, the press officer, who liked to joke, mentioned Barry West. Now, Barry hadn't made double figures. Mm. And so on a string of radio reports on local radio that afternoon, say, Willie Thorne became the fourth player to make a century of centuries. He joins, blah, 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 Steve Davis and Barry West, which couldn't have been further from the truth.
No, but in a strange way, that's why I put him on the list, because actually, we're talking about 35 years ago, he would have been just about in the top 32. Now, the equivalent player actually is a heavy scorer. So this is an example of how the strength and depth in the game has changed, because now, to be world number 30, you've got to be really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And indeed, world number 64. Mm. We're at the Championship League at the moment. I was looking at the schedule today, and you look down the rankings, and Stuart Carrington, world number 64, he just kept his card. Mm. And we all know how good Stuart is.
Well, he made three centuries in a row at the Crucible that time, didn't he?
Exactly. Now, the thing is, he plays in Group 12 as we're recording this today. Stuart Carrington, had he played to the level he plays at now, if he could get in a time machine and go back to 1990, he would definitely, without any shadow of doubt, be in the top 32. And I personally believe he would be bordering the top 16.
Mm. Okay, another number.
Okay, how about number one?
Well, you thought Barry West was a niche choice. I've gone for him for a reason which I'll come on to, but Nigel Gilbert. Now we're really digging the depths.
Okay, well, Nigel Gilbert was from Bedford. The two things I recall about him most, he came very close to beating Ronnie O'Sullivan at the UK Championship, lost 9-8. And a lot of the heavy gamblers who were around snooker at the time had a lot of money on O'Sullivan, and they were very, very concerned, because obviously that would have let their acca down. The other thing about Nigel was, and I can never understand this to this day, he went around with his own personal rest. Now, I can absolutely understand that, because if you're used to a rest, fine. You know, it can be a security blanket, and anything you're accustomed to in an alien environment helps. But this rest was one of those that everyone hated in the snooker clubs. It seemed to have this like really light plastic head. Now, I always found those to have no kind of stickability on the table. They were moving everywhere. So I could never understand why he had that. But he was a very good player.
Well, here's the thing. When you said there's two things, I can't believe one of them wasn't the fact he wore a glove.
Well, yeah, I mean, other players wore a glove, but yeah, he was the glove man, wasn't he? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, but that's why he's on the list, because I was thinking this week, obviously, it's very hot, and the venue's actually been okay, isn't it? They tried to sort out, like, aircon and fans or whatever, but if it gets sticky, and Ross Muir was here as well, because he sometimes worn one. I wonder why more players haven't done that, actually, down the years.
Well, it definitely works. Again, a story from Clive Everton. He played in the World Amateur Billiards Championship many years ago in Sri Lanka. So long ago, it was in Ceylon. And it was very, very hot, extremely hot, even for the country at the time. And basically, all players wore a glove in that, because otherwise they wouldn't have been able to cue. The other thing you can do, of course, is put a little bit of talcum powder in between your thumb and your forefinger. That does assist cueing. But again, you see, with Gilbert, the personalised rest and the glove, they were things that made him feel more comfortable under a pressurised environment. Mm. So why not?
He also, and this is a long-winded story, but it's a podcast. I remember watching him play Terry Griffiths in the World Championship on TV. It turned out to be 1990, because it turned up on YouTube recently. And Terry made back-to-back centuries. And the second one, it would have been the high break at that point in the tournament. I think it would have been 1-3-8. But he missed the last black, kind of rushing it, because actually he needed the toilet. He went running out to the toilet, right? And for some reason, I have a clear memory of that. But my memory of it, for some reason, and again, there's no reason I need to remember this. For some reason, in my mind, it was always on the left-hand table, you know, table two. And on YouTube, it clearly isn't. It's on the right-hand side. Now, this is meaningless in a way, but it's quite instructive on how we just remember things often not correctly, you know. I could have sworn, if you'd have put a gun to my head and said, which table did Terry Griffiths miss that black on, I would have said it's definitely, without question, the left-hand table, and it wasn't.
Happens all the time to me. I'm convinced about certain things, and then when I check them up, I've been proved incorrect. Not about the big things, but about, you know, little things like that, certainly. One thing with Gilbert, I have to say this, because he was doing well at one point in the early 90s, and I remember I played with a guy at our club. Again, I won't mention his name to save his blushes. He did actually turn pro in the end. And he was convinced that wearing a glove was the right way forward, so he went out and bought one. The only thing was, he bought it for the wrong hand. So he was using it for the hand that gripped the cue. He looked a bit like Michael Jackson. That was his only that was his only success.
You took part in many thrillers, but anyway, okay, another number.
Number 10.
Number 10, well, this is a well-known player, but I put him on, actually, because I thought we should pay him tribute, because he just retired, Nigel Bond.
What a gentleman. Mm. Absolutely lovely guy. Never did anything in his career that caused any controversy. Never came anywhere near close to disciplinary or offending anyone. When you can, you know, what is the measure of success in life? Is it, you know, lifting a load of trophies, or is it being universally liked by everyone you come into contact with? Well, if it's the latter, Nigel Bond is the champion of the world. He's such a genuinely thoughtful individual. I remember I went to Malta many years ago to an invitation event, and I took my mother with me. And he was so kind to Mom, and, you know, she always even now asks, how's Nigel? And that's how he was with everyone. So, yeah, so that's his character. With regard to his playing career, he had a very, very good one. And, of course, he won the British Open in one of the most dramatic finishes to any world ranking event final ever.
Yes, well, it was against John Higgins, of course. Deciding frame, needed a snooker and got it and won on the black. And there's foot, again, YouTube has it. Extraordinary atmosphere, actually. I mean, you know, you sort of, again, you know, people forget how big these tournaments were. You know, that was a huge occasion.
Absolutely. The crowds all week were really, really good. I think, you know, now, it's actually, for John Higgins, it really showed him something, because he was 69 ahead with 67 on in the decider, and he basically played a very conservative shot to get what he thought was over the line, when he could have easily played a good positional shot and potted the extra ball after the match ball. He didn't do that, and it cost him in the end. Bond cut in a really thin black from distance to win. And I was commentating with Willie Thorne, and Willie was genuinely crying in the commentary box. He was so pleased for Nigel.
Mm. He was sort of, in some way, I'll mention Terry Griffiths again, he was some ways like Terry in the 80s. Terry kept at the Crucible running into Steve Davis, you know, who was obviously the king of that time. Nigel played Hendry 4 years running at the Crucible, including famously in a final. But he kept running into him, and obviously, you know, that kind of stopped him getting nearer to winning the World Championship. But he must remember, he broke through very quickly. I think even in his first season, he was getting to like semi-finals. He got to the final of the Grand Prix quite early on, 1990, and stayed around a long time. He's only just dropped off. You know, no wild cards or anything. He'd been on for over 30 years. He beat Judd Trump in the UK a couple of years ago. So, you know, he right to the end, he was still causing people problems.
Yeah, I remember when he was coming through pretty much the same time as someone we've talked about before, Steve James. And I remember him in Pro-Ams being absolutely deadly. I remember he won a Pro-Am at the Silver Q Club in Birmingham on one occasion. And he won the final in about 25 minutes, 3-0. And you thought, yeah, he can do something. Mm. It was more difficult then, of course, in the late 80s to get onto the tour. But when he eventually did, he made waves pretty much immediately.
Does a lot of coaching now, I think. And, you know, would be a very good person, to go and learn from, because he's got a lot of knowledge. We wish him well, of course, in his retirement. We'll do a couple more, Phil. So we've had 1, 2, 4, 7 and 10 so far.
OK, number 8.
OK, well, number 8, again, I mean, this is a very well-known player, but we sort of haven't really discussed him on here too much since he passed away, sadly, Doug Mountjoy.
You know, I loved watching Doug Mountjoy play. He was so instrumental in so many big stories in snooker. Won the World Amateur Championship in South Africa in 1976, and just a few months later won the Masters Always such a good player to watch. And for me, yes, Matthew Stevens got so close to winning the World Championship. Jimmy White got so close as well. And the third person who I think could easily have been world champion, and he wasn't quite, was Doug. Mm. He won the Masters, he won the UK Championship. Now, that UK Championship, yes, he'd won it in 78. 10 years later, his game was in disarray. I remember him playing Neil Folds at the Crucible in the April before he won the UK. And Neil beat him very easily with a session to spare. And on one occasion, the white was close to the cube, white was close to the cushion, and he actually topped the white. It was really embarrassing. Then, of course, he got under the guidance of the legendary coach Frank Callan, and his improvement was out of this world. It wasn't just the fact he beat Stephen Hendry in the final of that UK Championship. It was the fact he made three consecutive centuries. Sometimes you can win a match without playing well. It's just, if the other guy has a bad day, you can come through. Doug played brilliantly in that match. He really did.
Well, yeah, the three centuries, the first time it happened had been only a couple of months earlier, Steve Davis. So it wasn't a regular thing at all. And then, of course, he won the next ranking event, the Mercantile Classic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, we were talking about this last year, or last season, actually. When Doug won the second UK, he was 46. Mm. He seemed like he was an old-age pensioner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because at the time, the game was, the demographic of the game was so much younger than it is now. And, of course, Ronnie O'Sullivan's now the world champion at 46. Yeah, so he went to the Mercantile. Now, that wasn't, it was a great story, but it wasn't a great final. He beat Wayne Jones, I recall, his fellow Welshman at Blackpool. Not a great match. One of the worst finals I've seen, actually. But the fact he won two world ranking events in such a short space of time at what we thought then was such an advanced age, great.
Yeah, and it's kind of nice as well that in the end he would, because he played in Mark Williams' club, and he would go in and just have a few frames. He's sort of gone back to where he started, really, just doing it for the love of it.
Mm.
It's nice to think that someone like that retained that love, and he wasn't bothering anyone. He was just sort of having a sociable game and still in touch with snooker.
Yeah, and I think Doug was on the first ever World, it was called the World Team Cup. Mm. It was the world first ever World Cup team. It was Doug, Ray Reardon and Terry Griffiths. And they didn't just beat England with a session to spare in the final. It was at Hayden and Hollisher Centre, which is very close to where I live. They beat them with a day to spare.
Yes.
Well,
it's a great team. I mean, yeah. That's sort of, you think of that time, that's the sort of holy trinity of Welsh snooker, isn't it, right there?
Absolutely. Yeah, he sadly missed Doug. He was a really good guy and a proper professional.
Absolutely. Okay, another number.
Okay, did I say number three yet?
No. Well, you'll like this one because he's a good friend of yours. Twice quarterfinalist in the World Championship from Canada, Jim Weitch.
I can't speak highly enough about Jim. He's got a club now in Toronto called the Corner Bank, which is really doing well, I'm led to believe. And I'd love to go over and see him at some point. I've studied his house in Oakville in Toronto, Jim. We've had some great times in the commentary box and elsewhere. What a talented individual he is. Apart from being a good businessman, as you say, he got to two quarterfinals at the World Championship. But also, he's a really good pool player. You know, he never played competitively. Had he done so, I think he would have done well. Good golfer, just a generally good person to be around. And as I say, when I was commentating with him, it was a joy. He was one of the first players who actually could be a lead commentator, certainly in pool. And I thought he did a great job over the years. He was very enthusiastic, and a youthful spirit. He's in his 60s now, but I think Jim Weitch, all the people I've met in snooker over the years, would be one of my best friends.
Yeah, well, that 92 championship, he got to the quarterfinals there. It was quite important to me, that tournament, because I would say it would be the one I most remember before I started working in snooker, definitely. I think because it must have been on during the Easter holidays, so I would have been off school, so I would have watched a lot of it. And obviously it ended with a very memorable final. It's 30 years ago now, by the way. We're as far away from that 92 championship as that was from the first Beatles record.
Yeah.
So yeah. If you want to think of it that way. Anyway, but I remember watching that tournament, you know, avidly. And I mean, I was already into snooker, but I think that definitely sort of cemented, you know, something. I think it was no stretch to say, but for that tournament, I might not be here now. There'll be people saying, well, you know, thanks a lot, 92, for that. But, I remember that tournament very clear. I remember Terry got to the semis. Keep talking about Terry Griffiths, but he got to the semis. Obviously, the Jimi Hendry rivalry sort of, you know, hit its peak. It was a great world championship, that was. Now, I'm not talking about standard, you know, if you want to look back at centuries, whatever, but that's not the point. It's about the memories it implants in you, and what it means to you. And obviously, he was part of that. And to get to the quarterfinals, you know, I think he got there in 80 as well. So it's quite a long time apart.
Yeah, and he wasn't playing continuously for 12 years either. He had a long sabbatical from the game. So, yeah, he was that kind of person. He was a very... He was very competitive without seeming it.
Yeah.
I think... Now, I'm going to get the almanac out after I've spoken to you, because I've got to check this. I think he beat Dean Reynolds and Willie Thorne to get to the quarters.
He beat Willie, definitely.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. You mentioned his commentary, and he was a great commentator. But that's proof of... He wasn't a multi-world champion. He wasn't a top player in the very elite sense. But he proved you don't have to be a great broadcaster. What you need is vocabulary, intelligence, and timing, and all the things that make great broadcasters.
Look, at the moment, you look at snooker commentary, and we can only gauge this from who we work with and how we feel when we work with them. Neil Foulds, absolutely gold standard. Alan McManus, brilliant. Simply amazing at his job. And someone we've worked with this week, Joe Perry,
yeah.
A couple of world ranking titles, but nowhere near winning the world championship, obviously a semi-final. And yet they are really good commentators who know the modern game inside out. You don't need to have lifted trophies to be able to communicate. Obviously, that gives you gravitas. There's no doubt about it. And some world champions are extremely good commentators. But it's not a prerequisite.
We'll do one more, Phil. So we've got 5, 6 and 9.
I'll go for 5.
Okay, well, we're sort of almost going back to where we started, because this is probably, he was a player, but best known for being a commentator, Jim Meadowcroft.
Right, well, I never saw Meadowcroft when he was playing at his best, nowhere near. In fact, for a large number of years, he was playing quite poorly. When I saw him, it was at the qualifiers, right at the end of his career. I recall that he... was on the receiving end of Alain Robidoux's 147.
Okay.
In the European Open qualifiers.
A very early one, that would be.
That would have very early one, yeah. He was a quarter finalist in the World Championship. That was before my time. Commentator as well. The other thing about Jim was, I thought he had a quite extraordinary hairstyle.
Mm.
Never changed, did it?
Mm.
Never changed over the years. But they all reckon, you speak to Dennis about this, they all reckon in the early 70s, he was a formidable player. I never saw that.
Well, this is the point, isn't it? There are players, I mean, Pullman would have been one, and even like Ray Reardon, whose best years came before the game became a professional sport as we know it, and they had opportunities to earn money from it. I mean, Reardon didn't turn pro till he was 35. It seems incredible. But Meadowcroft, I suppose, he's best known as a commentator. He was BBC man. He was on the end of the 85 final with Ted Lowe. And then went to ITV, and then I think he came back to the BBC. I think people kind of remember him quite fondly. He was one of those voices of that era, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's from a Bakehop in Lancashire, so he got that very good accent, which I love, from that area. Now, I can't verify this. I'll have to go on Q-Tracker and try and find this. Whether it will be there, I don't know. But there was some story...
Well, if it's not there, it won't be anywhere.
So yeah, okay. There was some story about the 80s where... He was involved in an extraordinary match against Graham Miles. I think it was somewhere down south. But anyway, the story was that obviously if you turn up late for a snooker match then, as now, you get docked frames. Yeah. And they were both late. And the story was it was 2 each at the interval and there hadn't been a ball potted.
Well, they started the interval.
Yeah, exactly.
He told me, well, you know, we can have a gossip here. He told me about the 85 final. I mean, I've no idea if it's true, but he said he wasn't supposed to do the end. He'd started early that evening. And the producer said to me, "said I think you're doing well. I'm going to keep you on," to the chagrin of one of the others. Now I don't know who the other one was. It may have been John Spencer. I don't know, but it may not be true. That's the other thing. But of course, his voice is always there, isn't it? You know, it's all that. I mean, that we know that gets replayed a hell of a lot. That final, he's always going to be part of that.
The other day here, Peng Yi Song made his TV debut as a professional, and he's got dyed grey hair. That, of course, got us talking about the Silver Fox, David Taylor. Yes. And you mentioned quite correctly, he was commentating on that 147. And so he's always there on that. It's a form of immortality.
Yes, well, and there'll always be this podcast as well. That's the other thing. Well, thank you, Phil. We didn't get time to do the others, but this feature will return. And, what if anyone has any suggestions for players, the more niche the better, that we could discuss in future, let us know. The email address is snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. Hopefully the background noise wasn't too off-putting. I don't think it was. And, what we got here, Phil, sort of general thoughts about the season ahead. I mean, obviously we're still missing the China events. That's out of people's hands. But pretty soon, you know, it's a sort of breezing ourselves in. But once we get into sort of October time, the tournaments are coming quite regularly.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the season ahead. I love the fact that there are so many stories within stories. This Championship League, whoever wins this, if they're not already qualified, they're going to the Champion of Champions. With the £33,000 they're going to win, they will more than likely play in the World Grand Prix, and that could get them into the Players' Championship and the Tour Championship. So these tournaments aren't islands anymore, are they? They're all interconnected, and that's what I love. With regard to the Chinese events, you know, the old phrase, be careful what you wish for. Those years when players were regularly going to China, a lot of them were moaning about the travel and the fact that the schedule was quite arduous. Now they aren't moaning. They wish they could go back because the events were extra special. They were played for big money, big world ranking points in front of an appreciative audience, whether it was either live or on TV. And so be careful what you wish for. We want to see snooker back in China quickly. And of course, when it does go back there, we've got the added spice that Zhao Xintong and Yan Bingtao will play there as major champions for the first time.
I have to say, just finally, you know, some snooker players, you do slightly question sort of their logic, because there was one yesterday in the players' room saying that he said it's now impossible to get in the Tour Championship. There aren't enough tournaments. Well, it's not impossible. Eight people will get into it. So it is possible to get into it. There'll be eight players in it. But then he said he hadn't done any practice for the new season. So I'm thinking, well, you're not really giving yourself the best chance, are you, to get in these tournaments if you haven't practiced? What have you been doing for 3 months?
I've always thought this. Always. And I'm speaking from a non-player perspective. But why do players have such a lengthy period off? Now, I can understand a period of decompression, undoubtedly. But in what other job do you get 3 months off? Now, if you practice hard for the start of the new season, because of traditions of not practicing amongst most players, you're going to be at a massive advantage, aren't you? And so you could get a real leg up on them, take the pressure off yourself for later in the season, which in turn helps. The Chinese players, by and large, haven't gone back to China since the World Championship because of exorbitant airfares and the COVID situation, all that kind of stuff. They've clearly been in the academies wherever they play, practicing hard, and that's shone through in the Championship League, where so far, seven of them have reached the second phase.
Yeah, and also, say you're a musician in an orchestra. The concert might not be for another month, but you play that instrument every day so that you can still play it to a high level. You don't just sort of pick up the violin the day before, do you? Anyway, we're sort of yakking now, so we'll end there. The Championship League will continue, of course, on Free Sports and Matchroom Live. The second table is on YouTube. There's all other platforms as well around the world. And we will return very soon. Sports Social Podcast Network.